Welcome back to another episode of Barely Legal in Web3. Today we're talking about digital asset risks in Singapore. I'm here with Angela Ong of TRM Labs. Angela, so great to have you here.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jamelia.
So to kick it off, can you tell us a bit about yourself and your role at TRM?
Sure. I'm Senior Policy Advisor for TRM Labs, and I'm responsible for Asia-Pacific public policy and government relations based out of Singapore. And before I joined TRM, I was with the Monetary Authority of Singapore for over 10 years, most recently as part of the pioneering team in charge of implementing the Payment Services Act in Singapore, where I was overseeing licensing for payments and crypto service providers.
Really cool. And at TRM Labs, I've taken a look and seen what you guys do. You guys are doing some really interesting stuff on forensics and investigations. Can you tell us a bit about what TRM Labs does?
Yeah, sure. TRM Labs is really a blockchain intelligence company. And what we do is that we help our clients across both public and private sector really use public blockchain data to fight fraud and financial crime. And just to use a little bit of an analogy here, what I like to describe TRM as is really Google Maps for the blockchain. Because if you think about public blockchains, it's a transparent and immutable ledger. So every single transaction that takes place on a public blockchain is recorded there permanently. And this is incredibly powerful when we're talking about detecting and fighting financial crime, because this data is real time and it's available to anyone. You know, as a participant in the crypto ecosystem, I don't just have a view of my own customer transactions like you would in a traditional financial institution, but any participant has a view of every transaction on the blockchain. In fact, you know, you could take a blockchain wallet address on a Block Explorer, which is like an Internet Explorer for blockchain data, and key it in, and it'll pull up the whole list of transactions. And even, you know, this is the same for regulators, law enforcement. Anyone has access to this data, but this data is not easily understandable to the layman because it's a series of hashes, cryptographic hashes. And what that's like is like looking at a satellite image with no context, right? You see green, you see blue, but you can't really tell what is this place that I'm looking at on this image. But when you look at a satellite image on Google Maps, you have location data, you can get directions, you can get traffic information. And that's really what TRM does for public blockchain data. We help to make sense of the blockchain ledger by layering on information, for example, wallet ownership, risk levels, three combination of open source as well as proprietary intelligence. So for example, if OFAC sanctions a wallet address, then that's reflected as a sanction. And we also have category experts that are enriching that information. These are people who are intimately familiar with specific threat landscapes, terrorism financing, child sexual abuse material, hacks, ransomware, and they know where to look for this information and identify the wallet addresses, usage patterns of all these bad actors. And then we put all this into our tool for our customers to really identify illicit activity on the blockchain. And, you know, in the case of private sector businesses, stop this activity from coming onto their platforms. And then in the case of the authorities, you know, it's really about, you know, recovering illicit funds, supervising their entities, and, you know, stopping the bad guys.
So if I'm someone that's, you know, transacting with cryptocurrency and I want to understand where my money went or who stole my NFT or all of these common use cases, not only can you guys help to track that in sort of the retail sense, but there's also these other business use cases. From what I understand, you know, OFAC is a huge concern. And really, on OFAC, for those of you that are watching and listening, OFAC is Office of Foreign Assets Control, and it's a U.S. Regulatory framework, and it's really about sanctions and sanctioned parties. So you guys really have insight into connecting the wallets to those parties as well.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, you know, while there are like individual use cases for blockchain analytics tools like TRM, the institutional use cases, both across public and private sector, are far more wide-reaching. Law enforcement, regulators, private crypto businesses, financial institutions, really anyone who has an interest in the crypto landscape and in detecting illicit activity or even just understanding transaction patterns can be a consumer of blockchain analytics.
It's so interesting to hear how these sorts of ways that we're using technology, we're using sort of the data, the metadata that is being created on the blockchain, and then taking that and analyzing it and being able to provide a service. I want to kind of talk a little bit about your background as ex-MAS, which is Monetary Authority of Singapore, and how you transitioned from that role into where you are now with TRM.
Yeah, it's actually quite interesting because people are like, oh, you're from a very traditional background. But actually, I was part of the payments team looking at payments, crypto. And so when I was looking, you know, for transition to the private sector, this was kind of like a very natural choice. Crypto compliance. I mean, compliance-centric business models, it always speaks to regulators, right? And I think for me, I was also looking for, you know, as a former government employee, I was looking for a sense of mission. That's always very important. And I think I was really very, very fortunate to find that at TRM, because you can really see how our tool is being used by businesses and authorities to fight financial crime. And that's, you know, hugely meaningful.
So you've had the experience of being on the regulator side and looking at payments licensing and applications for businesses that are coming in and wanting to sort of do this activity. And now you have the experience of being on the other end, on the business side. What sort of have you noticed and what are some takeaways from being able to be on both sides of the table?
Yeah, so it's funny that you asked that, Jamilia, because, you know, when I kind of joined TRM and I started to get involved in some of these regulatory consultations from the industry side, someone in one of my working groups was like, oh, it's so useful to have Angela because she speaks regulator. It's like he said, oh, she speaks Latin or something, right? But I mean, I think that kind of like is a unique perspective. Having walked in those shoes, I do understand how regulators think, why they do what they do, and, you know, equally important, the constraints that they have, what's top of mind for them. And, you know, now in the private sector, I come one step closer to understanding the priorities and concerns of businesses. And especially with TRM's unique position, fighting financial crime in crypto, working with both the public sector and the private sector in our client base, you know, we really get to see both sides. And we also hope to help to really be a bridge in many of these conversations as well.
It's, you know, there's a lot of myths around what happens when an application is submitted. And we like to, you know, do some myth busting here. One of the myths is that I submit an application for payments licensing and it goes into a black box. But actually, there's a person on the other end, right? Can you talk a little bit about
there
that?
There is a person on the other end. It's not, you know, regulator GPT. You know, you are very much dealing with a flesh and blood human being. Regulators are not impenetrable fortresses made up of unfeeling robots. And, you know, to any, you know, compliance professionals, especially watching this, when you feel frustrated and overwhelmed in dealing with, you know, regulatory processes, just pause and remember the feeling is probably at least a little bit mutual sometimes. And I think one of the things that I like to, you know, bring to bear, kind of at least speaking from the Singapore experience coming from the MES, is that regulators are not there to set you up for failure. They're not there to regulate your business out of existence. You know, in fact, you know, in the Singapore experience coming from MAS, it's really wired into our DNA almost from day one to consider both sides of the coin in policy making, risk and innovation. I mean, to be fair, in the crypto space, the fulcrum has shifted to focus more on risk in the wake of, you know, incidents like FTX. But there is still very careful attention being paid to understanding practical implementation issues, to listen to industry feedback. The nature of it is that, you know, regulators will not always agree with the industry. In fact, many times they will disagree, but there's very much this openness to discussion. And they also want to understand, you know, how would you implement this requirement practically? And if there are some constraints, we want to understand that, because I think the regulators know that the quality of regulation is only as good as the quality of implementation.
So what I'm hearing you say is that regulators are people. There's someone
Indeed.
On the other end
yes, there
of
is.
Receiving that application. And then also that there is this communication or feedback loop that has to happen. And in your experience, what are some of the best practices or ways to kind of foster that or promote that in your line of work?
I think the first thing is, as we talked about, you know, both sides, there are people, remember that, and kind of leading with empathy. I think conversations do benefit when both sides approach the discussion with more empathy. You know, for example, if a regulator is saying no to, you know, one of your requests, or they find that, you know, they want you to fix this or change that, you know, instead of just going in and bulldozing and saying, this is why you should be saying yes, you know, it's also important to pause and think, like, Why might they be saying no? So I think a lot of that that kind of posture, the posture of the conversation is very important. I think in Singapore, the MAS is very much focused on fostering both a safe and vibrant financial system, and it's important to remember that you know, it's not, the regulation is not here to kill the industry. It's here to help the industry grow in a sustainable and responsible way.
That's so true. And this idea of having a relationship that's ongoing before just sending the application into what you think may be a black box, it's not really a black box. I want to talk a little bit about being a woman in fintech. And, you know, fintech, both the financial services side or the financial side and the technology side, are pretty male-dominated industries. Can you tell us or share a little bit about your experience in the space and some of the things that you've sort of noted on to sort of be successful?
Sure. I think, you know, I think it's true. Like, the numbers do show that there is a wider gender gap in fintech and crypto. That's a fact. You know, I was just looking at some of these studies, and like a global gender gap report by the WEF says that women account for about 40% of the workforce and about 32% of senior roles. But, you know, when you're looking at industry specific studies in fintech and crypto, it's about 30% of the workforce. And, you know, in terms of senior roles, that's maybe 6-7%. So it's something that we need to really work at. And the one thing I would say is that both men and women need to work on this together and to really be more intentional about, you know, diversity and inclusion, and to be more aware of our unconscious bias. And I want to highlight a really great example that's happening in the crypto industry, which is this initiative actually called Unmantle Your Panel by the Association for Women in Cryptocurrency. Amanda Wick and her amazing team basically came up with this idea to get, you know, men to pledge not to speak on a Mantle, which is a all male panel.
I love that.
And there are about 120 pledges, and many of them posted publicly on socials, including many of my TRM colleagues, super proud. You know, hello, Ari Redbord, Kyle Armstrong, John O'Newman, really, really great allies. They signed up to this, and you know, I especially love what Ari Redbord, our global head of policy, said about this initiative, that it's not about forced diversity, but it's quite the opposite. Because why he's doing this is because the best conversations include women voices, because we work in an industry filled with extraordinary women. So I think it's really something that, you know, we can do better together. And there are two things that I want to say. One to the men, is that lifting up women, it's not about putting down men. It's about rising up together and doing better together. And then to the women, a little bit more spicy, there's a special place in hell for women who don't help each other. I didn't say it, Madeleine Albright said it, okay? So I think, you know, this inclusion journey is something that I really hope that we will go on together. And you know, I think to all the women out there who are looking to, you know, advance their careers in fintech and crypto, I say go for it. You know, all of us have something unique to offer. And I think a lot of times women struggle with imposter syndrome and self-doubt. And don't let that hold you back, because there are so many people, both men and women, that are rooting for you. And I think we can just reach out, get advice, and really just keep swimming.
You know, first of all, that's an amazing program. Not to speak on a Mantle, a man panel. You know, it's funny to me, because I've seen that there are some just programs in the fintech space or in the crypto space that maybe the creator or the organizer of the program didn't really intend to have a impact that excludes women, but that is the actual impact that's had. And I'll give you one example of that. There's this program in UAE, in Dubai, and we'll go nameless, where they have set up about 4 villas for Web3 founders to come in and create. And you basically live in the villa, and it's just a big community where founders can come in and co-create and share ideas. Everyone's working on their own project. Well, the impact of that is how many women founders would feel comfortable, you know, sharing a room or otherwise apartment with other male founders. And so you have the result is that women don't participate, and then they are left out of that experience. And so, you know, to your point, it's also about this proactive thinking of what is going to be the result of what I create.
Yeah, you absolutely. And I think, you know, I was having this conversation with Amanda Wick, who's the founder of the Association for Women in Crypto, about precisely this. I think the issue here is just really we are all prone to unconscious biases. So it's not like there's somebody sitting up there saying, let's keep the women out of the room, right? But, you know, if you're trying to organize an event, and, you know, you know, let's say you invite your 5 friends and maybe they all happen to be men because you guys know, go way back. It's not like you sat down there and said, like, I don't, you know, I want to exclude the women, but it's just like it's just easy kind of like to default back to what's familiar, what's similar to us. And that's why it's very important to have these kind of like inclusion initiatives, because it helps us to be more intentional about inclusion. And I like to share this anecdote about one of the pledges for Unmantle Your Panel, a guy called Rahul Advani, a senior policy director for Ripple and a really great friend of mine. And he was, you know, after signing this pledge, organizing a policy summit in Australia. And because he had signed the pledge, he was much more conscious and intentional about inclusion. And because he thought about it, you know, that conference actually ended up having 51% women speakers. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very much about being intentional about, you know, overcoming some of our unconscious biases and our default modes.
That's really, you know, this intentionality, this idea to put it to the forefront. You know, sometimes I also play the devil's advocate and I think, is it that we are not intentional enough, or is there something about women, this imposter syndrome, that prevents us from really, you know, taking the leap or stepping forward? And, you know, look at your career. You've, you know, in the legal space and policy space and the tech space and the financial services space, all of those spaces are, you know, historically male dominated, but you overcame it and you're thriving in that. So is there something that you think that you've kind of clung to that has helped you do that?
I think it is recognizing the value of your voice in this space. And I think in this aspect, it is very important to have a group that's rooting for you. And I think what more women out there who are struggling with imposter syndrome need to be aware of is that there really are a lot of people rooting for you to succeed. And that's why, you know, we're like at TRM Labs, we are so supportive of initiatives like the Association for Women in Crypto, because it's really kind of important to have that community and to realize that you're not alone. But I think, you know, it's always remembering that you can bring value to that conversation and kind of sometimes really just keep swimming, putting that self-doubt away and just, you know, just go for it.
Yeah, I agree. And I do have to say, Singapore is a place where I think that you're allowed to kind of show up and be yourself. And particularly for the women's initiatives, there are a lot of them. And so it's definitely a place where,
absolutely,
you know, women lawyers, women who are in fintech or financial services, there's so many resources.
Yeah.
And I'm not just saying that. I'm just saying it like from experience that's at least what I've experienced here. So kind of moving on and switching gears, I want to talk a bit about, you know, some of this cool investigative work that TRM Labs does, because I know you've been involved in some cases that are pretty cool. And can you tell us or share with us a story about something that you've worked on that you think is pretty unique?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I must say I'm not a frontline investigator, but we have some excellent frontline investigators, former law enforcement, many women as well, exceptional. And I'm so proud to be part of a company that's doing amazing work across public sector, private sector to really fight financial crime. And would love to share a couple of stories that I find really hugely rewarding. Recently, the US Secret Service actually used the TRM tool in an investigation on a pig butchering scam. And as we all know, these are getting more and more commonplace and they're very damaging. So the term originates from Chinese, sha zhu pan. And it's basically a long con where scammers really gain victims' trust and then they take them for everything that they're worth. So in this case that was, you know, investigated by the USS, the scammer actually was luring victims into investing in a fraudulent crypto platform. And in total, about 5.5 million US dollars was sent by 7 victims to the scam trading platforms. And what happened was that one of the victims realized that they had been scammed when they were basically unable to withdraw their investment gains. And then they reached out to the USS for help. So using the information provided by the victims, the investigators at the US Secret Service, they were able to plot the flow of funds in the TRM tool from the original investment platform address through dozens of addresses and multiple types of cryptocurrencies that eventually basically led them to a self-hosted wallet where the funds were just sitting. And this is actually quite common for scammers to park stolen funds in unhosted addresses for days, weeks, or even months at a time. So what the investigators did was that they actually set monitoring alerts of all these wallet addresses in the TRM tool to notify them each time there was any sort of fund movement. And this is very critical because you have to, you know, for asset seizure, wait for quite a specific moment, which is basically when the scammers think that they've gotten away and they transfer the funds mm-hmm. out of these self-hosted wallets to cash out at a crypto exchange. That can really be a prime opportunity for a law enforcement intervention because then there's an entity that they can reach out to cooperate. But this must be done very, very quickly before the funds are allowed to pass through the crypto exchange. And as we know, you know, in crypto, this can happen very quickly. Mm-hmm. So what happened here was when the funds finally moved out to an exchange, the Secret Service received an alert. And with the data that they had gathered from blockchain analysis, as well as other evidence, they were actually able to secure a seizure warrant within a couple of hours. And they were ultimately able to seize about $5 million in stolen scammed funds. So I think, you know, it's very rewarding. It reminds us that there's a very human impact to the work that we do. And it's such a privilege to be part of that. But I also want to kind of talk about some of the other use cases, maybe a bit closer to the business side of things. So aside from law enforcement agencies, we also work with regulators, and they are using our tool to carry out real-time surveillance and supervision. You know, when we talk about regulatory reporting, that's kind of beholden to certain cadences, right? It's monthly, quarterly, yearly, whatever the case is. But using blockchain analysis tools, regulators are able to look at their regulators' activities on the blockchain in real time. In fact, not just regulators, but in fact, any crypto service provider, they can use, you know, blockchain analysis to even identify providers who may be carrying out unauthorized business in their jurisdiction. So it's a hugely powerful tool that regulators have added to their arsenal. And then on the flip side, we have crypto businesses and financial institutions that are using that same tool as part of their compliance controls. You know, whether it's client onboarding, ongoing transaction monitoring, or compliance with obligations like the FATF travel rule. And, you know, we work with many of the world's leading crypto exchanges and regional global and exchange, regional and local crypto exchanges to really integrate TRM as part of their anti-money laundering controls. So I think that one interesting use case that I want to highlight here is in DeFi, because, you know, people are thinking about compliance in DeFi. Is that really possible? And actually, with public blockchain data and the right tools, financial crime controls are very much possible, even in this decentralized environment. In fact, in recent years, we've actually seen a marked rise in interest from DeFi players in terms of proactively introducing compliance controls, even though the regulatory landscape for DeFi is still kind of evolving. So we work with DeFi clients like the likes of Uniswap, One Inch Network, and what they do is that they actually leverage the TRM blockchain analysis tool via APIs. So using APIs, they actually query for data on blockchain addresses, transactions to detect these addresses or transaction hashes exposure to illicit activity, you know, across various categories, whether it's sanctions, terrorism financing, hacks, or, you know, ransomware scams, human trafficking, what have you. And then TRM returns the results of these queries with a risk factor around the specific wallet address or transaction hash. And then our DeFi clients use that information to systematically restrict these addresses from interacting within their protocols. So, you know, they are, by this kind of like API connection, DeFi protocols are actually able to screen millions of wallet addresses that seek to transact within their protocols, even in a very decentralized setup.
We always say that data is power, and that's a lot of power. I mean, to be able to pinpoint and track, first of all, where money is being taken from after it's been stolen. And then also to be able to just plug and play into these other platforms to really allow them to use their data to understand what's happening. It really is powerful. So, I mean, I think that the main point here is that we have the blockchain and all that information is transparent and public, but the everyday person can't use it. And you guys are really, you know, looking for ways to leverage that data and create products off of it as well. So I think that's really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really meaningful to see it have a very real impact in terms of, you know, building a safer financial ecosystem for everyone.
So kind of just, you know, bringing all of this around to a good circle. In Singapore, you know, one of the things that we were talking about on another discussion was this idea that building in Singapore can be challenging because of the regulatory restrictions. And that's a myth that we busted, is that, you know, there are guidance measures in place for creating businesses in the crypto and the digital asset space. But really, overall, it's an encouraging environment. What would your advice be to founders or people who are listening and watching that are considering building in Singapore?
Well, I think it's very much the organizing principles that we talked about earlier, Jamelia. It's really that kind of proactive engagement, empathy, trying to understand why some of these regulatory requirements are set up in a certain way, and just having that conversation. And I think Singapore is very much a jurisdiction where, you know, the regulator is you know, focused on providing regulatory clarity, where there's an openness, a dialogue, where, you know, it's a consultative approach. So I would really encourage businesses to take advantage of that.
Great. And what about for women lawyers or those looking to get into the fintech space? They see you, they're listening to all this cool stuff that you're doing and working with government agencies and regulators, but maybe they have a bit of imposter syndrome. What would your advice be to them?
Go for it. I'm rooting for you. Always happy to, you know, to have a chat and you know, let's help each other.
That's great. Angela, thank you so much for appearing on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure.